All right, well, if you have a Bible, go ahead and find Job. Any Awana kid knows it goes Job, Psalms, Proverbs. You can say it in one syllable. So find Psalms and go backwards. Going back all the way to the beginning of this summer, while we were still meeting together over there in the fellowship hall, because this room was being renovated and remodeled, I got into the habit of using my Sunday evening preaching times to slowly piece together a biblical understanding of trials. If you follow the church on social media or you see our slides in the lobby, the foyer area, you might have seen the one that labeled Life in the Valley, a biblical theology of pain and suffering. And when we started this way back at the beginning of the summer, I had no idea that the summer would be as trying of a time as it turned out to be for a lot of people here at Calvary Baptist Church. And it's good, it's natural and right when we go through various trials or we experience pain and suffering in life to want to know why, right? Why is this happening, God? What is the reason for it? And so far in our study, we've uncovered a few different examples. What I want to emphasize the word is possible examples. We've seen different passages of Scripture that have given us different reasons why maybe we might be suffering. There isn't any one-size-fits-all answer for pain and suffering in our lives. I can't tell you the reason why you have pain and suffering in your life any more than I could tell you, say, the reason why your garden didn't grow. If your garden doesn't grow, there could be dozens of, maybe you didn't water it. And maybe you planted pineapple bushes in Michigan. Maybe you have a black walnut tree in your backyard that makes everything so acidic that it kills all the plants that you plant. Not that I know anybody like that. Maybe you didn't weed it, or you planted winter wheat, but it was May or something. I don't know. There's a bunch of reasons why. And pain and suffering, when you read the Bible, is kind of like that. The best we can do is read Scripture and look at this passage and that passage and say, maybe this, maybe that. I can't look into your life from the outside in and tell you why you suffer. But maybe if we read the Bible together, God and His Holy Spirit will illuminate things in such a way that you go, man, that makes a lot of sense when you read it in His Word. So because of that, my goal when I get up here every time on Sunday night is just simply read a part of the Bible with you and see what that passage of Scripture has to say for why your suffering might be occurring. For example, we read in 2 Corinthians 1, and we noted that God may allow suffering into life as ministry boot camp, as preparation for future ministry, so that when we have come through the suffering, when the trial is over, and we look back with perspective and clarity, we can then help people who are in the middle of it. That's one possible reason why. But we also read, what was it? Oh, that same passage of Scripture, 2 Corinthians 1. Paul wrote and he said, but this happens so that we might learn to rely on God and not on ourselves. And that God may use pain and suffering in our lives as a means to break us of our independence from Him. We also read in John 9, though, with the man born blind, that God may bring or allow or engineer even suffering in our lives for the express purpose of using that suffering in our life to bring or to give glory to Himself. That there's a higher purpose at work that we don't see. That God has a way of bringing glory to Himself and completing His works and making them known through our suffering. But we also looked at sin. We read in the Bible that sin plays a significant role in suffering. Number one, in the fact that sin breaks things, sin corrodes things, and it ruins the world. It causes brake lines to corrode, and so you have a car accident just because sin destroys things. But it can also see, we sin, and our sin brings discipline from God as a loving Father. And so one of the possible reasons why we sin is, or excuse me, why we suffer may be because we're sinning. It's a question we need to ask. All of that is where we've been. Tonight we come to the book of Job. I'm quite certain that Job and his story are familiar to probably all of you on one degree or another. I want to tackle things a bit differently tonight. I'm going to stick with me as we go, because I'm going to take things out of order in the way it's written down here. Okay, I'm going to start reading at the very beginning of Job. Job 1 is just going to be chunks of scripture tonight. So the first one we're going to take is Job 1, 1 through 5. It says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of their feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' And thus Job did continually." Right, that's the one side of the coin of the story of Job and the picture that we're used to seeing and thinking about. Right, lots of money, lots of family, lots of stuff. Put it all together, and all Job really needs is a 2-story frame house and a white picket fence, and he's got the American dream lived out, a few thousand years ago here. And from everything we can tell and from everything we read, Job was completely successful in everything that he did. I don't have a handy-dandy conversion chart that'll tell you, how many donkeys equals a tractor or something like that to compute Job's net worth and translate it into, I've seen those attempts, they're mostly guesswork, I think. Suffice it to say that Job was rich. Right? Job was successful. It says he was the greatest of all the men of the East. And by anyone's standards, he was sitting fat and happy and sitting pretty, as the saying my grandpa would say would go. But of course, we know that doesn't last. At this point, we know something that Job didn't know, but I want to try and not know what Job didn't know. I want to take a deviation from reading Job's story, from the normal walking tour of the book of Job. We just read about Job and how successful he is and how awesome he's doing. I want to skip. Drop down on your page to verse 13. We're skipping the exchange between God and Satan for now, because from what all we are able to tell by reading is that Job knew nothing of it, that God kept it from him. All he knew was that one day he was fat and happy and sitting pretty, and the next, verse 13, the next day, it doesn't say the next day, but on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people and they died. And I alone have escaped to tell you." And that is the other side of the coin from the beginning of chapter 1 that we are used to thinking about when it comes to the picture of Job in our minds. See, one after another, 4 servants come up to report what an insurance adjuster in our conversations would call a total loss. Right? Your livestock, Job, camels, oxen, donkeys, a total loss. Your sons and daughters, a total loss. Everything and anything, Job, that you thought was going to give you security and stability, everything you were basing your entire life on, Job, it's a total loss. And oh yeah, I'm not actually an insurance adjuster, and you don't actually have insurance, Job. So at this point in your life, as you know it, is a total loss. Except, of course, it's not. Not yet. I mean, it will be soon. We're going to read. It's going to get worse. But skip to chapter 2, verse 7. I'm skipping Satan. One as just a personal slight and an insult. You're unimportant, and we'll leave you till later. But now, I want to read, just pile on top of poor Job. Chapter 2, verse 7. Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he sat among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." And things go from bad to worse for Job. He's now not only destitute, stricken, afflicted, but berated by his wife to boot. Right? This is the one person on earth who is supposed to stick with him no matter what. And Job has now become, probably without exaggeration, the most aggrieved person in the world. No indication is given to us between chapter 1 and chapter 2 how much time passed. It's at least a day, you suppose, but you have no idea other than that. But it's like a country song come to life on steroids. Because when you think things can't get worse than that, they do. I know my wife laughs at me because I like to listen to country music, but sometimes, so often, it's just about hardships in life. And flip two pages, go to chapter 4. Let's read the next thing to befall Job. Before we read in chapter 4, verse 1, I need to note that the speaker here in chapter 4 is a man named Eliphaz. Eliphaz is a friend of Job's who has come to visit with him and to allegedly, according to chapter 2 that we skipped over, quote, sympathize with him and to comfort him. Keep that phrase in mind. Eliphaz is here as a friend to sympathize and comfort Job. Verse 1. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered, "If one ventures a word with you, Job, will you become impatient? Who can refrain from speaking? Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. And by the breath of God they perish. By the blast of his anger they come to an end." That's friend number one. That's sympathy and comfort from friend number one, who's come on the literal worst day of your entire life. And the message of sympathy and comfort that friend brings to you in your hour of need turns out to be, quote, "According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble harvest it, and by the breath of God they perish." What friend number one says to Job in the middle of his suffering is essentially, "You're getting what you deserve, Job, because God punishes the sinful. So if you're being punished, Job, it's your own fault." That's not even cold comfort from a friend. That's not even your friend who means well but says the really wrong thing at the wrong time. That's an assault. Let's leave him behind. We're done with Eliphaz. He wasn't very helpful. Go to chapter 8. We're going to skip over Job's response to Eliphaz. We're going to read about friend number two. Friend number two is Bildad, also come, according to chapter 2, so that he may offer, quote, "sympathy and comfort," end quote, to Job. Chapter 8, verse 1, "Then Bildad the Shuhite answered, 'How long will you say these things?'" speaking to Job. "And the words of your mouth be a mighty wind. Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert what is right? If your sons sinned against him, then he delivered them into the power of their transgression. If you would seek God and implore the compassion of the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely now he would rouse himself for you and restore your righteous state." I mean, geez, what is with these guys? Right? We skipped over over Job's response to Eliphaz in order to gawk at the insensitive nature of his friends. But after chapter 4, when Eliphaz accused Job of being punished, you're being punished, Job, because you're sinning. Stop sinning and your life will go back to normal. It's essentially his message. Job spends a considerable amount of effort in chapters. You look at chapter 5, you look at chapter 6, all of chapter 7, pleading his innocence to his friends. I'm not being punished for sin, he says. He never claims to be perfect. He just says, I'm walking with God, to use our terminology. I don't deserve this in terms of punishment and discipline. So, friend number one calls Job a sinner, saying he's only getting what he obviously deserves. And Job says, that's not true. You got to believe me. I don't. And friend number two calls him a liar. And, don't know if you caught it, says that your sons deserved what they got too. I skipped around on purpose because I want us to feel the full weight of the calamity that falls on Job. We tend to think about, or I tend to think of the calamity of Job as losing everything, meaning his house and his kids and his money. Things have gotten to be so ruinous for Job. I mean, in chapter 1, yes, he lost all his earthly goods and all of his children. In chapter 2, and it speaks really of the depth of Job's suffering that I can say that so dismissively, right? 2, he lost his health and he lost his wife. And in chapters 8 and chapter 4, he loses his friends. At this point in the book, Job is quite literally all alone. He has absolutely nothing left. He has no one by his side. It's him and the ashes and the potsherd. And that's it. And with that, we come to chapter 9, where Job speaks. Job 9, verse 1, Job answered, "In truth, I know this is so, but how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in 1,000 times. Wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defied him without harm?" And then for the next 28 verses, Job launches into this speech that has one purpose, to separate man from God and to show the infinite gap that exists, the chasm between what I am as a person, as a man, and what he is as God Almighty. I want us to feel the desperation of Job. I want us to enter into his situation mentally as much as we can, as much as our prosperity will allow us. And the best we're able to do that is just to read the exasperated words of a man in chapter 9 who is desperate and to feel his frustration. Verse 5, he says, "It is God who removes the mountains, they know not how. When he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars, who alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the sea, who makes the bear Orion and Pleiades the chambers of the south, who does great things unfathomable and wondrous works without number. Were he to pass by me, I would not see him. Were he to move past me, I would not perceive him. Were he to snatch me away, who could restrain him? Who could say to him, 'What are you doing?'" In these verses, what we find is Job is crying out helplessly against the strength of God. Right? These verses serve one purpose and one purpose only. Just a list of rhetorical questions meant to illustrate the fact that Job has an absolute total inability to stand up to God. How do you fight against someone, Job asks, who can literally move mountains? How do you plead your case to someone to whom the stars in the sky are like glitter on an art project? If someone like that, Job says, has been aligned against me, I have no adequate defense. Nothing you can say will make even the slightest bit of difference if that's your situation. It'd be just like shouting into the void and listening as all you can muster just gets sucked up and swallowed by nothing. And if that's your situation, Job says, you have no hope. And that is exactly where Job thought he was. He has no hope, no friend, and he knows it. Some of you have been there. Maybe not in terms of the exact replication of circumstances. My guess is your camel herd is not quite as robust as Job's was. But I'm talking about being helpless before God. Job had been, he's just talking about being cast adrift. He's floundering in whatever life he has left. And that's what suffering does. It breaks you down and it brings you to the end of yourself. In commenting on this chapter in particular, Steve Lawson summarized things this way. He said, Job believed that God was wearing him out, leaving him exhausted. He, quote, would not let me regain my breath. Job feared that God would overwhelm him with misery. He had no doubt that he would be devastated in a debate in court with God. In any direct confrontation with God, Job knew he had no hope of winning. Right, it's not until this point in chapter 9 that I think we are sufficiently informed enough about the suffering that Job was under to maybe try to grasp a little bit of the depth of his pain. Because it isn't until chapter 9 that Job hits the lowest of the lows. Because in chapter 9, Job concludes that the absolute worst has happened, and that is that God has abandoned him. He absorbed the loss of his money. He absorbed the loss of his kids. Even when his wife turned against him and God alike, it says Job did not sin. His friends turned on him, and he stood firm. Most of the book is Job arguing with his friends. But even when he thought all of that was it, he could take it. But it wasn't until chapter 9 when Job thinks that God has abandoned him, and now he's done. He speaks of being used up, dried up. It's almost like he's given up. Look at chapter 10, verse 1. I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint, and I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. And you read that, and you can just feel the weight of Job's words. It's like his sorrow has become a presence in the text. I mean, truly no one, I think, has ever suffered like Job has suffered. And that's what makes him the perfect example for us to learn from. Paul wrote in Romans 15, and he said, the things which were written down before were written as examples for our learning, that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. Now the temptation, the easy temptation, is to paper over things, right? With something maybe half true. Oh, you think you've got it bad. Come on, buck up. At least you're not Job. That's not the lesson. That's not the hope that Paul wants us to get from the Old Testament Scriptures. No, Paul says that by studying the Old Testament Scriptures, we can be instructed in such a way that we can learn how to live now in our suffering and be encouraged in our circumstances. By the example of those who have gone before us, we will gain hope. From Job, as the case is before us tonight. So one of the first things we learn from Job is one of the possible reasons why we may suffer. We skipped over it, but let's go back. Chapter 1. It's all the way back to the beginning. We skipped it because Satan, whatever. There's an old line from Martin Luther. He said he woke up one day because he heard, quote, a knocking about in the attic. And then he realized, quote, it was only Satan, so I went back to sleep. I don't know what Luther heard in the attic. That guy was tough. Job 1:6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. There's a sobering thought. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. And the beginning of chapter 2 is the next conversation between God and Satan. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? Where there's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his own life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Right? This is the peak behind the divine plan, behind the curtain that is God's plan that we don't normally get to see, that we are privy to because we're reading the written text, but that Job knew absolutely nothing about. And we learn from these two parts of Job that he was subjected to pain and suffering because God was using him to prove a point to Satan. There's a psalm that says that God silences the accuser. Satan had asserted to God, "People only love you because you give them stuff." Yeah, Job loves you. He has a good life. "Take away the good gifts," he said, "and Job will turn on you." God, of course, says, "Not so. I can prove it to you." He says, "Take Job and put him to the test. Take away anything you want. You'll see. Job will remain faithful." So Job suffered because he was being tested. The test could essentially be boiled down to the question posed to Job, "Which do you love more, Job? God or the good things God gives you?" Tonight, we need to consider our own response to pain and suffering for a moment. John Wooden used to compare people and adversity to a teabag and hot water. He said, "Put the teabag in the water," Wooden would say, "and whatever's inside is going to automatically come out." And the same is going to be true for people. Immerse a person into adversity, and what is inside of them will inevitably come out. That's why Wooden always said that sports don't build character, they reveal it. Well, what came out of Job is what will hopefully come out of us. Look at the end of chapter 1. I'm going to read in chapter 1, starting in verse 20. This takes place right after Job learns that all 10 of his kids have died all on the same day. "Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head. And he fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.'" Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Job was the teabag. His suffering was the hot water. Job gets plunged into adversity, a test like you and I are probably never going to face. And what came out of Job was worship. Once again, I have found the words of Steve Lawson, his book on Job, to be illuminating as we think about Job and his response to suffering. Lawson writes this, "Job's life revealed the marks of a true and vibrant faith. Such an authentic trust finds at its core a sincere fear of God. The emphasis here is that Job feared God, a reality rooted in knowing the Lord. This is where the Christian life begins. Such a reverential awe is foundational to any personal knowledge of God. Fearing God is, quite simply, taking him seriously in our lives and giving him the unrivaled place of honor that belongs to him alone. Job refused to elevate the good gifts of God to a place above God himself. Job could endure his suffering because he knew God. Job passed a test he didn't even know he was taking because he already feared God above all else. I am sure Job loved his life, but he loved God more. I have no doubt that Job loved his family. You can see that in chapter 1 in the way he cared for them spiritually and the way he functioned as a priest for them. He loved his family, but he loved God more. Job consistently demonstrated, and we saw that in chapter 1, that he loved God and he lived for God as a matter of course, as a matter of habit in his life. God allowed Satan to test that love, and we would be kidding ourselves if we didn't at least consider the possibility that the same thing could happen to us. Is it? I have no idea. Job didn't know either. I don't know if your suffering is or will be or was the result of a test from God or not. Just like when we read 1 Corinthians 11, and I was very, 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 very careful and specific to say, I don't know if your suffering is caused by sin. I didn't want anybody going home, putting on Twitter, telling your mother, Pastor Ernie said that you have cancer because you're a sinner. Tell your mother that. It's not true. I didn't say that. But what we see from Job is that it's at least a possibility that we will be tested by suffering. What we see from Job is that in the middle of his pain, in the middle of his suffering, Job was supported by a faith in God that existed prior to his suffering. It did not grow up overnight, and it did not result from his suffering. It was there in his life before. So when we suffer, let's pay attention to our response. One of the ways we can know if things or comforts or good gifts from God have become too important to us, if they have replaced God in our affections, is how we react when we lose them. If we sin when they're taken away, Job's were taken away. That's an indication, a warning sign to us that we have begun to love the gifts of God more than God himself. Job lost everything but God at chapter 1. But the end of chapter 1 says, yet in all this, Job did not sin. Job didn't. It was made possible by his prior attitude of faith and his pious life. I mean, in this sense, Job is not a lesson necessarily for people who are currently suffering. Because when you're in the thick of it, it's a little too late to build up a reservoir of faith in God. You get plunged into the hot water and all you're going to have is what you've already cultivated. So what Job then becomes a call to action for people who are not yet suffering, relatively speaking. A call to go home today after church, tomorrow before work, and to get busy getting to know God. Get busy cultivating faith and building a trust in God. One of the things I hope you do as a result of reading Job is to strengthen your relationship with God. Job could bear up under the weight of his suffering because he had the backbone of a previously developed trust in God. Do you? Right? Or for that matter, do I? Is it ever possible to be prepared enough for suffering? Probably not. But let's not kid ourselves. It's coming at some point. The challenge Job gives us is to be ready when it does. To be living like Job and actively cultivating spiritual faith and maturity so that we are able to withstand the suffering when it comes. This is Job's example for us. It said the very first book, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. Job gives us the prescription on how to cultivate a spiritual faith in God that will stand up to suffering. Job, it says, was a man who feared God and turned away from evil. And if we would be ready to pass the test that will come through suffering, we need to do the same. We need to fear God more than we fear man. We need to fear God more than we love ourselves. And we need to turn away from evil. The temptation is usually to be like Lot, who got seduced bit by bit by bit into evil, drawn into sin until he was neck deep and couldn't find his way out on his own. This week, let's make like Job instead. Let's turn away from evil on purpose and actively seek out God instead. Let's close the browser window. Let's choose to not get around the filter even though we know we can get away with it and cultivate prayer and faith with God instead. Let's submit our attitudes. Let's submit our appetites to God for His approval as we turn away from evil and we turn towards God. And when we do that, there's something powerful about saying no to sin. I mean, I make jokes about the devil. I'm like, oh, you're not important, you know. But there's something special and something powerful in your spiritual life that happens when you tell the devil to shut up and go away. Because my faith is in God and I'm turning to Him right now. That's one thing we can learn from Job. There's still more we can emulate from Job. Look at chapter 1, verse 5. Job 1:5, when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. That little phrase right at the end, that tiny sentence just kills me. Thus Job did continually. Without going into everything that would be required to explain these ancient customs and worship of God and how that would have functioned in the pre-world, pre-law world. It's enough to note here that Job was active and intentional at continually worshiping God, at living for Him. That worship of God was not an optional add-on for Job. It was part and parcel of his life. Thus, Job did continually. So let's be like Job. Let's cultivate an active and intentional life of worship for God. This is going to mean public worship, meaning you go to church, meaning you make going to church a priority with your family. I work with teenagers and students quite often, and if you want to undercut your kids' faith, if you want to lessen the chances that they're going to make it through trials on their own, just teach them that other things are more important than the worship of God. And that'll be a big part of it. Skip church for soccer. Spoken to someone who loves soccer, probably a little too much. Sleep in Saturday morning instead of going to men's ministry. Right? Miss Sunday school because you're up late at the movies and now we're tired. Job had a foundation of worship and faith that wasn't built up overnight. It wasn't built up in the convenient times. He had a foundation of faith and worship that enabled him to bear up under the weight of life in the valley because thus Job did continually, worshiping and living for God. That the worship of God was the foundation and the center of his life. Let's consider tonight. What are we centering our lives on? What are we teaching each other and our kids and our grandkids about what is most important? What do we spend most of our time doing and planning and spending our money on? Once you've identified that thing, ask yourself, will that be enough when the pain starts? It was for Job. Richard Wurmbrand was a Romanian pastor who got imprisoned by the communists and thrown into prison. If you've never read his story, you should. It's called Tortured for Christ. You can actually get it for free. I'll send you the website if you want it. But he said one time about the things that we give up. He said, we give up only what we imagined we believed. That's pretty good. That's Job. The question tonight is, what about us? What are we centering our lives on? What are we building on? And is it going to be enough? Okay, that's two positive lessons from the life of Job so far and his suffering, right? About building faith and these kinds of things. There's one negative lesson from Job that I want to learn. We got two be like Jobs, and we're going to have one don't be like Job. Go to chapter 19. We're skipping now. While you're doing that, I want to tell you, if you want a challenging But rewarding Bible study that you can do on your own over a period of weeks or however long it takes you. The book of Job, the biggest challenge in it is it's really long and really repetitive and really poetical. Read the book of Job one chapter at a time and read it until you can summarize that chapter in one sentence. And then write that down and move on to the next chapter. And then go read those sentences and you'll have an awesome idea of what Job is about. Okay, you should have found chapter 19 yet. I want to read verse 6 is what I want. Job 1:6. Know then that God has wronged me. He has closed his net around me. Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. All right, we could keep reading more than those two verses, but that's enough to get the gist of Job's attitude. Notice how many chapters have passed between 9 and 19. 10 chapters have gone by in Job's life. At this point in the book, Job has degenerated into anger. He has allowed himself to be indignant with God. And this chapter, what it becomes the verbal raising of the fist at God, that God has wronged me. That's what he says. God has wronged me. And Job has moved from questioning God. He's now accusing God. That's not a shift that you necessarily want to make. That's not a part of Job's attitude that you want to emulate. Roy Zuck wrote a commentary in the book of Job. This is how he evaluates Job's eventual attitude. Job's experience demonstrates that a believer, while undergoing intense agony, need not renounce God. Question him, yes, but not deny him. Like Job, he may long for an explanation for his experience, but being unable to comprehend the cause of his calamity, he need not curse God. Job also teaches that to ask why, as Job did, is not wrong, but to demand that God answer why, as Job also did, is wrong. To insist that God explain one's adversities is inappropriate, for it places man above God and it challenges God's sovereignty. Earlier when we read in chapter 9, we hinted at the reason why Job eventually got to this point. He thought that God had abandoned him. He thought that God had left his side and taken up a position opposite him, in opposition to him. Job thought that he had been left by God to walk through the valley by himself. And Job was wrong. There's no other way to understand it. At the end of the book, by the time you get done, Job has been straightened out. Right? God straightens him out and Job learns the truth. God never abandoned him. God was there the whole time. Job just didn't know it, whether he had eyes to see or not. From this, we take an understanding of something else that we can learn from Job. God does not leave us in our suffering. Ever. Even when we might think he does. Quite to the contrary, actually. And the last thing that we can learn from Job tonight is to not be like Job. Don't wrongly conclude that God has abandoned us when we suffer. Because if we do, what we're going to find when we come through the other side of it like Job is that we were wrong. God was with us the whole time. There's an old poem that everyone, I think, from a certain generation is going to be familiar with. It hung on the wall of my grandparents' house, right next to the door. It's called Footprints in the Sand by Mary Stevenson. It's a little fanciful. It goes like this. One night I dreamed I was walking along the beach with the Lord. Many scenes from my life flashed across the sky. In each scene I noticed footprints in the sand. Sometimes there were two sets of footprints. Other times there were only one set of footprints. This bothered me because I noticed that during the low periods of my life, when I was suffering from anguish and sorrow or defeat, I could see only one set of footprints. So I said to the Lord, "You promised me, Lord, that if I followed you, you would walk with me always. But I have noticed that during the most trying periods of my life, there have only been one set of footprints in the sand. Why, when I needed you the most, have you not been there for me?" Sounds like Job, right? The Lord replied, "The times you see only one set of footprints is when I carried you." It's a familiar poem for a lot of us. It aptly illustrates the truth of Job that when we walk through the valley, God goes with us, even if we don't realize it at the time, that God will not abandon us. And that is one lesson we need to learn from Job, that when the pain starts, we're not alone. Trials, suffering, pain in life, they're either going to drive you towards God, as they initially did for Job, or they're going to drive you away from God, as they eventually did for Job. There's an addendum to that poem. I don't think many of you are familiar with it. Came out a little bit later. I want to show it to you as we end. Jim, go ahead and put up that first one. Footprints in the sand, carried along by God. Right? That's Job chapter 1 right there. No, I did not draw this. In this regard this week, right? Let's be like Job. Let's trust in God's promises to be faithful. Let's cultivate a walk with Him that can stand the storm and the trial and the pain. Let's love Him more than what He gives us. Okay, Jim, go ahead with the second one. That's Job in chapter 19. In that regard this week, let's not be like Job. Job accused God and said, "You left me." And God says, "No, I just had to pull you for a while." So this week as we go, let's think about Job. We know the story of Job, the suffering of Job. We know the ending of Job. Let's be like Job in chapter 1. Let's not be like Job in chapter 19.